I'm very grateful for this invitation. I haven't had many opportunities to talk about the project, and I can't imagine a more appropriate audience. What I'd like to do this afternoon is to describe the edition I've been preparing and situate it in relation to some of Evelyn's other works, including the diary. I'd like to conclude by taking up some of the problems the correspondence poses, particularly in the context of some issues which I hope will be of interest to this audience. As Roger said, I've just submitted to the University of Toronto Press an old spelling annotated edition of the letter books of John Evelyn, which I've co-edited with my colleague and friend Douglas Chambers, now retired from the Toronto English Department. Evelyn's letter books are two folio manuscript volumes owned since 1995 by the British Library and now catalogued as BL Additional Manuscripts 78298 and 78299. Prior to that date, they'd been owned by the Evelyn family and kept at Wotton House, Surrey, and after 1949 at Christchurch. They contain 7 letters in Latin, 24 in modern European languages, and over 800 in English. The collection opens in 1644, when Evelyn was in Italy, writing in Italian, and then in the English letters in 1645 in Venice, then passes through his final return to England in 1652, and continues until a rather abrupt conclusion in 1698, 8 years before his death. In all cases, the correspondence is outgoing. He does not include any incoming letters. Both manuscripts are in Evelyn's hand and give evidence of his attention over a prolonged period. These are texts he made a deliberate decision to preserve in this format, and they sometimes give evidence of various forms of editorial intervention. The manuscripts mimic some of the characteristics of printed examples of the epistolary collection. As was conventional in such collections, the letters are divided into 4 libri, Book 1 comprising the Latin letters, Book 2 the letters in Italian and French, and 1 each of German and Spanish. Book 3, 405 letters in English from 1645 to 1679, and Book 4, another 404 letters in English and 1 in French from 1679 until 1698. The Latin and vernacular letters are numbered consecutively, the Latin beginning with letter 35, and arranged chronologically, as are the 2 books of English letters, albeit with errors in sequencing. Each letter has a headnote and often also marginal annotations, and there are tables of contents and an index for both volumes at the end of 78299. As Evelyn's attention to the formal properties of the collection suggests, the letter books represent his attempt to edit his own correspondence for an audience he imagined to consist, in the first instance, of his descendants. My title, Editing Evelyn, Editing Evelyn, raises a set of questions around the problem of editorial regress. Evelyn's own editorial work is obviously central to these concerns, but the issue also emerges in relation to the history of our edition. Douglas Chambers began working on Evelyn's correspondence in the early 1990s. His original intention was to produce a collected edition of Evelyn's letters, but it soon became clear to him that the idea of a complete edition was overly ambitious and would have to await more systematic efforts to produce a census of Evelyn's surviving letters. At this point, he decided to focus on an edition of the 2 letter books on the assumption that they provide a logical starting point for any subsequent attempts to produce the larger work. Douglas worked on this edition from 1993 until 2004, when he was forced to stop work for reasons of ill health. The project remained in hiatus until 2008, when, with several other friends and colleagues, I agreed to bring it to conclusion. Douglas's work on the edition was very far advanced. He had transcribed the 2 manuscripts and checked his transcriptions against the originals. Corrections to the text of the first letter book had been incorporated, while corrections to the second volume were still in progress. He'd also done considerable work on the annotations and had assembled extensive biographical materials on Evelyn's correspondence. Translations, particularly of the Latin, had also been prepared. Douglas had acquired a large archive in support of the edition. This included illustrations and correspondence associated with his work. However, several weeks after the files had been copied from his computer, a catastrophic fire at his farm resulted in the destruction of all of the archive for the edition and any files not already copied from his computer. It was soon clear that some important materials had not survived and that significant work remained to be done before it could be published. Almost all of the translations and the identification of sources had been lost, and the surviving text did not include many of the corrections and probably also the latest versions of some of the annotations. In addition, no materials pertaining to his projected introduction or to his acknowledgments could be recovered. What I had to work from was a copy of the printout on which he had entered his corrections during proofreading, and about 800 computer files, essentially unorganized and in some cases with serious problems of formatting. And from that, I created my own copy text. Later, I also had PDF images of the manuscripts to work from as well. The project required some startup work on my part. As Roger said, I'm Spencerian by training and had hardly ever worked past 1625 and certainly never palled around with royalists. Fortunately, some of my own areas of interest, the history of the book, the history of libraries and collecting, and early modern theological controversy, were also important for the edition. I began work in 2009 and spent several periods in the British Library checking the transcriptions and bringing the references to other Evelyn manuscripts into line with the new catalogue of the archive. I rewrote large sections of the annotations, produced the preliminary apparatus. But there had also been important developments in Evelyn scholarship in the period between 2004, when Douglas stopped work, and 2009, when I began, largely stemming from the movement of the papers to the BL. A series of conferences, most importantly the 2001 conference published as John Evelyn and His Milieu, had emphasized how multifaceted Evelyn's career had been. There were also now serious biographical works based on the archive, and most important for my work, the archive had been described and cataloged in great detail by Francis Harris and made available online. All of these developments facilitated my work tremendously. Evelyn's letter books belong alongside his famous diary, which has been continuously in print since 1818 and was edited to the highest standards of scholarship by Esmond de Beer. But only a small selection of the letters has ever appeared in print. Most manuscripts, including the letter books, were unavailable to de Beer when he was working on the diary. 19th century editions of Evelyn's diary printed some of the correspondence, often in excerpted form. Other letters have been published in the editions of some of his correspondence. And while some have become well known, such as the 1659 letter to Robert Boyle, proposing a little foundation modeled on Bacon Salomon's house, and his 1689 letter to Pepys about libraries and collecting, it was only in 1997 that a significant portion of the correspondence, the letters to and from Samuel Pepys, appeared in a reliable edition. The letter books represent only a small portion of Evelyn's surviving papers. Excluding materials preserved in other archives or acquired earlier by the British Library, the Evelyn collection is catalogued in 526 volumes. Of these, 131 volumes contain papers directly associated with John Evelyn, including, apart from the letter books, 22 volumes of his correspondence. Other volumes include the manuscripts of his diary, his commonplace books, and his many devotional manuscripts. In addition, there are important materials relating to his library. Other sections of the archive include the papers of his wife Mary and his son John Jr., as well as the papers of his descendants and other historic manuscripts associated with the Evelyn family or with the family of his father-in-law, Sir Richard Brown. In total, they comprise one of the largest family-based archives of early modern material and a collection of English 17th century correspondence without many rivals. Just let me pause for a moment and emphasize the research potential of the archive as a whole and not merely the correspondence. Two examples. Evelyn's commonplace books are among the most extensive to have survived, and his sermon registers provide unparalleled access to preaching on the ground in Restoration England. But also two questions. What is the relationship of the letter books to the rest of Evelyn's surviving correspondence? And is it possible to reconstruct the history of the text as de Beer succeeded in doing for the diary? As he demonstrated, much of the diary was compiled many years after the dates to which it refers. De Beer realized that the descriptions of monuments and artifacts in Evelyn's account of his travels in France and Italy derived in many instances from published sources which appeared in some cases years after the dates of Evelyn's visits. He was also able to use forward references to later events to hypothesize a complex textual history in which the diary was begun as early as the 1660s, was taken up again in the early 1680s, and only became contemporary with the events it describes in 1683-84. A crucial stage in the composition of both the diary and the letter books seems to have occurred early in 1682. Evelyn had been very ill at the start of the year. He notes that he only continued so weak that I could not go to church till Ash Wednesday, which I had not missed, I think, so long in 20 years. The illness prompted him to put his affairs in order. He also notes that he began to look over and methodize all my writings, accounts, letters, papers, etc., inventoried the goods of the house, etc., and put things into the best order I could, and also made my will. The earliest reference in the diary to the letter books occurs at this point. Evelyn had written to Daniel Colwell on February 11th, proposing changes to the Royal Society's criteria for membership. By early March, he'd recovered from his illness, and notes on March 9, came to see and congratulate my recovery Sir John Lowther, Mr. Herbert, Mr. Pepys, Sir Anthony Dean, and Mr. Hill, which last gave me a hopeful account of the success of my letter was like to have, which lately I sent to Mr. Colwell, in behalf of the Royal Society. He adds, see a copy of the letter in my book of letters. By this point, then, the diary and the letter books are being developed in tandem. But is it possible to cast any further light on their composition? The forms of evidence which De Beer used in inferring the history of the diary are typically of little value here. The letters are not dependent on later published sources for descriptive detail. Evelyn also attempts to avoid anachronism and to be scrupulous in his use of titles. Typically, each addressee is identified in the headnote by a title appropriate to the date of the letter. Although Evelyn often provides information on later honors or appointments for his correspondence, these typically take the form of marginal annotations, which cannot usually be used as evidence for the date at which the letters were first copied into the collection. Some inferences can be drawn, however, from the index, which Evelyn added at the end of the second volume. The index to the English letters is quite carefully laid out. Evelyn divided his pages into alphabetical sections and then entered the names of his correspondents. The first page, comprising A to G, is quite crammed, while later pages are more generously spaced, with adequate room for additions. The name of Richard Anderson, who is addressed only once in a letter of 23 May 1684, clearly belongs to the original iteration of the index, and that's the first example on the handout. It is followed by a cross-reference to Henry Bennet, Earl of Arlington, which is equally clearly a later insertion. The name of Frederick Tyne, who is addressed on September 22, 1685, is also evidently an insertion into a list which had already been created, and that's the second example on the handout. In other cases, additional names are added out of alphabetical sequence at the end of entries for particular letters. More precise evidence is also provided by the entry for Thomas Spratt, who was identified as Dean of Westminster, a post in which he was installed on September 21, 1683. His subsequent appointment as Bishop of Rochester, a position in which he was consecrated on November 2, 1684, is acknowledged in a reference which was clearly added to the initial entry. And this is the third example, and we can see where now Bishop of Rochester has been written above. It seems possible to infer, therefore, that the index was compiled between the end of May and the beginning of November 1684. And further, that subsequent to this date, letters were entered in relatively close proximity to their dates of composition. In this respect, the letter books are very similar to the diary and seem, much like it, to have gone live in 1684. It is unlikely to be a coincidence that the number of letters per year increases significantly at this point. But the question still arises as to when the project was begun, and how far did it advance before Evelyn recommitted himself to it in 1682-84. Here, the evidence is thin. One of the most distinctive features of the first letter book, however, is a noticeable change in Evelyn's handwriting on folio 180, which contains a letter to Edward Hyde of September 14, 1669. From this point onwards, the writing is much smaller than on the earlier pages and shows many of the properties of his later hand. It seems possible, then, to hypothesize that he had begun the letter books prior to this date and had reached 1669 before suspending the project and returning to it in the 1680s. It may also be that at least part of this work was done in the mid-1670s. With the exception of a 1686 letter to Antonio Verrio, which is not indexed, all the Latin and the vernacular letters are prior to 1676. This hypothesis still leaves unanswered the question of the date at which Evelyn began entering the correspondence, but a date in the 1660s, as De Beer proposed for the diary, certainly isn't impossible. This argument also raises larger issues of the relationship between the diary and the letter books, and the status of both as documentary records. That Evelyn's archive of his own correspondence was incomplete and imperfectly organized is suggested both by the relative paucity of letters from early in his life and by Evelyn's recurring difficulties in dating them. Not surprisingly, he is particularly prone to misdate letters prior to March 25th of any given year. The dating of the letters to Benjamin Maddox and to Jeremy Taylor from the 1650s is very confused, as are the letters of the 1670s to Thomas Clifford. Other correspondence from the 1670s is also liable to be misdated, again suggesting that the archive from which Evelyn drew his materials when he returned to the project in the 1680s was fragmentary. In some cases, the misdating is obvious. A letter to Margaret Cavendish, which I've included on the handout, is dated 6 months after her death. Another to Merrick Casaubon, 3 years after his. It seems likely that in many instances, particularly in the case of the earlier correspondence, Evelyn entered the text from a rough draft he had retained after dispatching the original letter. The letter books were not intended merely as a documentary record of Evelyn's correspondence. In many cases, the letter book versions differ from the text sent to his correspondence, as is shown by Guy de Labedière's edition of the correspondence with Pepys. In some cases, both in the letters to Pepys and in other examples, such as the letter to Margaret Cavendish, there is even reason to doubt that some of the letters were actually sent, and to conclude that some might be more appropriately understood as rhetorical or scholarly exercises by Evelyn than as documents of communicative acts. In at least one case, a letter was readdressed from Robert Hooke to Christopher Wren when it was copied into the letter book. In another case, which also points to his recycling of materials, a poem first dedicated to Cooley in 1666 was readdressed both to Flower Hyde and to Anne Spencer, with minor variations, in 1690. There are also interesting differences between the testimony provided by the diary and the correspondence. Some characters are absent from one or the other, or appear in different roles. John Beale, who is Evelyn's most prolific correspondent on horticultural matters, is unmentioned in the diary. By contrast, in the particularly important case of Margaret Godolphin, whose presence in the diary is pervasive for several years prior to her death in 1678, there is only one letter to her in the letter books, and it records a difference between her and Evelyn on a matter of crucial importance to him, and more about that later. It seems possible that Evelyn conceived the diary and the letter books as parallel and complementary testimonies to his life and as carefully edited reshapings of primary materials. The diary emphasizes the public existence. It gives little access to his interior life. It focuses much more on his public career as traveler, as close associate of public figures, and as a member of the Royal Society. The letter books are quite different. On September 10, 1665, Samuel Pepys heard of the Earl of Sandwich's capture of several Dutch ships. Wanting to celebrate, he visited his friend George Cock, whom he found with Viscount Brunker and his mistress, and Sir John Menes, Sir William Doyley, and Mr. Eveling, with whom he had corresponded on official business for several months, but had first met the previous day. The good news inspired into Sir John Menes and Mr. Eveling such a spirit of mirth that in all my life I never met with so merry a 2 hours as our company that night was. Among other humors, Mr. Eveling's repeating of some verses made up of nothing but various acceptations of may and can, and doing it so aptly upon occasion of something of that nature, and so fast, did make us all die almost of laughing. Readers of Evelyn's diary may have some difficulty recognizing this figure. For some of them, Virginia Woolf's claim that all that he wrote might be read aloud in the evening with a clear conscience to his children, and even her suggestion that we wonder then why we still trouble to read what we must consider the uninspired work of a good man, offer a quick, if uncharitable, assessment of the author of the diary, all the more if he's contrasted to Pepys. As Gillian Darley observes, Wolfe's Evelyn is a Victorian construct, praiseworthy for his exceptional piety, his discretion, and his steely morality. But even Wolfe's judgment is embedded within layers of doubt and qualification that find much support elsewhere in the Evelyn archive. For readers of his correspondence in particular, this John Evelyn comes as less of a surprise. The letter writer is prone to break into occasional, even nonsense verse, whether in commenting on the situation of royalists in 1650 or recalling an evening of sack posset in 1664. On other occasions, he moves exuberantly through panegyric to parody and invective, or from father admonishing his son and religious controversialist to raconteur of scandalous behavior in interregnum London. Evelyn's tonal variety also draws attention to his command of the early modern letter and its classical antecedents. His correspondence spans its generic range, from the Ciceronian alternatives of the familiar and the jocular to the severe and grave, to more formal exercises in Plinian description and Senecan instruction. He particularly valued the intimacy and expressive power of the letter. As he noted in 1692, writing to Charles Spencer, "I am bold to affirm that there is more good learning to be gotten from epistles than from all the rest of their works, more of the soul and most intimate thoughts and deepest knowledge of the writers, St. Cyprian, St. Augustine, St. Jerome, etc., of the fathers, Calvin, Melanchthon, Vives, Politianus, Grotius, Salmasius, and our own countryman Ascham, etc." Evelyn was attentive at the same time to the copious potential of the single letter and to the formal possibilities of the collection. Although Erasmus offered him a crucial precedent and model, Evelyn quotes more frequently from the more contemporary examples of Grotius, Scaliger, and Salmasius. In the already cited letter to Charles Spencer of January 15, 1692, he provides his protege with a survey of the genre, from its classical origins to its current manifestations in various European vernaculars. Evelyn describes his work as a pedagogue as almost finished. "Having now tempted and sufficiently provoked your lordship in Plautus, Cicero, Pliny, Seneca, Lipsius, etc., for your lordship is master of all styles, I give it over." Spencer had been instructed in the full range of the Latin letter, but lacks adequate English models. In contrast to the range of examples in various continental vernaculars, Evelyn can point only to Bacon and Donne in English, and Ascham in Latin, and to the flawed example of James Howell's Epistolae Hohelaniae. The letter books respond to the need for English models, even if he only intended them to be read within his family. Many of the individual letters can function as textbook-like models of epistolary kinds. But the letter books also provide striking examples of the literary potential of the collection. He uses rhetorical strategies based on juxtaposition and repetition, for example, in ordering the letters of 1665. Both Evelyn and his companion, Sir William Doyley, were members of the Commission for the Sick and Wounded and Prisoners of War, having been appointed to these posts in late 1664 in anticipation of the outbreak of the Second Anglo-Dutch War. By September 1665, the situation had become desperate. Evelyn lacked the resources to cope with the numbers of wounded and prisoners pouring into his zone. But he was also dealing with the plague, which had first been reported in London in July and was claiming several thousand lives a week by the beginning of September. In early August, he had dispatched his son and his tutor to the safety of his brother's estate at Wotton. At the beginning of September, his wife had also left for the country. On September 9, the day before his evening with Pepys, he had written desperate letters to George Monk and Henry Hyde describing the crisis and pleading for additional support. 3 days later, he wrote again to Hyde, apologizing for the style, the mistake, and the length of this earlier letter, while continuing to bombard government officials with requests for additional support. But if the rhythms of his public duties constrain his other interests, the Evelyn of these letters does not abandon them. On June 20th, he wrote to Sir Peter Wick, explaining that his duties prevented him from participating in the committee established by the Royal Society to examine the state of the English language and attaching suggestions for linguistic reform. Nor was his correspondence with Henry Hyde confined to issues arising from his official role. The letter of September 9 also describes the effects of the plague on the London book trade and provides a glimpse of John Wilkins, William Petty, and Robert Hooke at Durden's house in Surrey in retreat from the plague, where they are excogitating new riggings for ships, new chariots and new ploughs, etc., so as I know not of such another happy conversation of virtuosi in England. Evelyn also addressed Hyde on the topic of his translations of Jansenist polemics against French Jesuits, and in a letter of June 21st on the study of ancient history and the ancillary resources for historical research. This is one of the earliest examples in the collection of the letter as instructional essay, a form he would continue to explore, often in correspondence with Pepys, for the rest of his career. Such letters often privilege the catalog-like list, or in a visual correlative he takes up in 1667 in a letter to the Earl of Clarendon, the portrait gallery. These impulses culminate in the famous letter of August 1689 to Pepys, which begins by recalling Clarendon's gallery and goes on to survey and catalog English collectors of portraits, medals, and manuscripts and printed books. The letters of 1665 have a powerful cumulative force, enabled both by the abrupt increase in the number of letters for that year and the sense of unfolding disaster projected by Evelyn's sequence of unheralded appeals to members of the government. By contrast, his treatment of 1688, the Annus Mirabilis, works by delay and by withholding events which the reader inevitably anticipates. For much of the year, public affairs are kept off stage. Letters of consolation play a major role, to the widow of his brother Richard over the death of her daughter, and to Anne Spencer, Countess of Cumberland, who labored under the double burden of a son successfully drinking himself to death in Paris, and a husband converting to Catholicism. Much of the correspondence of the summer concerns Evelyn's visit to Althorp, the Spencer estate, in August. But abruptly, in October, the focus shifts. An anonymous letter to Archbishop Sancroft congratulates the bishops on their acquittal and warns of Jesuit intrigues against the Church of England. It is followed by a very brief letter to Flower Hyde, Countess of Clarendon, acknowledging the receipt of plants for his garden and recalling that Cicero, for you read his work and understand him too, reproaches, you know, a gentleman for being solicitous about his fish ponds when the Commonwealth was in danger of invasion. Another letter also uses anonymity, on this occasion to a purportedly noble addressee, and lays out an extensive program for political and religious reform under a new government. The year concludes with a lengthy letter to his son, who had joined the Prince of Orange, describing the final days of the Stuart court at Whitehall before James II's flight, and a letter to Anne Spencer, which attempts to impose closure on the year and offers the pursuit of moderate things in life as an alternative to this conjuncture present and approaching revolution. The stylistic variety in Evelyn's letters befits, in Erasmus's words, any good go-between, for the letter performs the function of a messenger and will take account of times and persons. This concept of the letter, though, also figures Evelyn's desire to fashion himself as a figure of social and cultural mediation. Two spatial metaphors define his place in the correspondence. He occupies a position both at the center of several epistolary circles and at the peripheral points at which these circles intersect. These contradictory locations facilitate a complex variety of mediations and acts of cultural brokering between different social and intellectual worlds. In a well-known essay, Michael Hunter has argued that Evelyn's career in the 1650s was tied to his imagined role as a mediator between England and France. His earliest publications, the translation of La Mode de Veilles of Liberty and Servitude, The State of France, and his Libertin-influenced translation of Lucretius, bear out this suggestion. But his understanding of the logic and rhetoric of mediation and of his own distinctive social location remained in place throughout his career, even after his links to France had weakened. Many of the French language letters in Book Two are letters of recommendation, in which his friend Jasper Needham and his brother-in-law William Glanville are introduced to some of his most important French contacts. But the largely Huguenot composition of this list dictated that Evelyn's links to French culture would become frayed as religious persecution intensified, And later letters, such as the 1689 letter to Pepys that I've already referred to, recast his relationship to France in more critical and competitive terms. But he also reformulated his understanding as a position, his understanding of his position as mediator. Instead of emphasizing translation from one language and culture into another, Evelyn's selections from his post-Restoration correspondence emphasize his role as broker and facilitator of cultural and social transactions between different social groups and cultural formations. Such mediation can take the form of a relatively straightforward, if sometimes ethically dubious, act of transmitting information or requests from one correspondent to another. We sometimes see him taking on this role on behalf of his patrons, whether acting on behalf of Henry Howard and trying to persuade his brother George not to stand for Parliament, or on behalf of Robert Spencer in communicating the news to his unsuspecting friend Elizabeth McCarty of the hasty marriage of Spencer's daughter to her 16-year-old son. Other letters represent him initiating a relationship between his patrons and their potential employees. Shortly after his return to England in 1652, he collaborated with Edmund Waller in obtaining a position as tutor for Christopher Wace in the household of the Earl of Devonshire. Later, acting on behalf of his friend Sir Samuel Tuke, he attempted to recruit William Croon as a tutor in Henry Howard's household, reminding him that he will here come into a most opulent and worthy family, and in which I prognosticate, and I have it assured me, that you shall make your fortune without any further dependences, for the persons who govern there have both the means to be very grateful and as generous a propensity to it as any family in England. Such transactions were not confined to the civil sphere. Evelyn also took up an active role in advancing the clerical aspirations of some of his protégés, such as William Stringfellow, and in promoting the early career of Richard Bentley. Evelyn's navigation of the world of the book is a special case. Here, both the nature of his affiliations with his correspondents and the larger relationship between mechanical and intellectual activity on the one hand and between knowledge and the marketplace on the other assume particularly complex forms. Several letters accompany books or acknowledge them as gifts. One which takes such a form is an exercise in mock panegyric addressed to Margaret Cavendish, that's the letter on your handout, and is represented as accompanying his gift of Silva in response to books received from her and the Duke of Newcastle. And it's, you probably can't read it there, but it's an extremely funny letter. In other cases, such exchanges can touch on different aspects of Evelyn's engagement with this world, whether as author, collector, or advisor. His relationship with Edward Phillips, Milton's nephew, is a case in point. Evelyn had employed him as a tutor in 1663, after assuring himself that Phillips was untainted by his uncle's politics, and subsequently recommended him for this role to the Earl of Pembroke and to John Langham. They were in contact again when Phillips solicited an account from Evelyn of his negotiations with Colonel Herbert Morley immediately prior to the Restoration for inclusion in the continuation of Sir Richard Baker's Chronicle that he had undertaken. Subsequently, in 1677, Evelyn helped Phillips attain a position in the household of Henry Bennet as a scholar to read and entertain him sometimes. Phillips, in turn, later assisted him in seeing numismata through the press. This was a role in which intellectuals came into direct contact with mechanicals, with consequences that Anthony Grafton explores in the culture of correction in Renaissance Europe. Failure to properly discharge the role of press corrector was particularly vexing for Evelyn and led on several occasions to anger and frustration. He repeatedly blamed Thomas Triplett for carelessly proofreading his translation of Lucretius and attributed his abandonment of the project to this disappointment. He was no more satisfied with the printing of Numismata by Benjamin Took and complained about it in several letters. The uncomfortable fit between authors and printers and the absence of satisfactory procedures for quality control, as demonstrated by these episodes, is one of the major themes of a 1666 letter to the Earl of Clarendon, in which he proposed reforms to the book trade in the wake of the Great Fire. As a translator of Gabriel Naudet's instructions concerning the erecting of a library, it is not surprising that Evelyn was also engaged with this topic. In some cases, the stakes were personal. In 1652, shortly after his return to England, he attempted to broker the sale of John Cosin's library to his cousin James Stevens, and when these negotiations collapsed, endeavored unsuccessfully to buy the books himself on installment. Later, he provided advice on the purchase of libraries, recommending to Thomas Osborne against the purchase of the Earl of Bristol's library, and to Henry Bennet in favor of the acquisitions of Henry Oldenburg's books. Evelyn also represented himself as a facilitator or agent in the transmission of other cultural properties. He was proud of his role in arranging Henry Howard's gifts of the Arundel marbles to Oxford in 1667, and includes several letters which highlight his mediation between Howard and the university authorities. Subsequently, he also arranged the gift of the library at Arundel House to the Royal Society. He is also careful to draw attention to his own status as donor in letters to Peter Pett and Thomas Barlow, alluding to his donation of prints to the Bodleian. Other transactions, though, have a more mercenary underpinning. A letter of 1684 to Johann van der Does describes an attempt to persuade Howard to sell his Raphael drawings, and he was also actively involved in trying to sell the Countess of Bristol's Chelsea home to Sir Stephen Fox. Evelyn was particularly interested in drawing attention to his role in brokering relations between the Royal Society and its sponsors, critics, and supporters. Fragments from his early abandoned project on the history of trades were presented at some of the early meetings of the Society, and this project also pointed forward to the more elaborate forms of coordination and collaboration he would devise for his unfinished Lyceum Britannicum. The letter books also include a 1664 letter to Robert Boyle describing snow pits in Italy, which Boyle printed in his New Experiments in Observation Touching Cold. In 1667, Evelyn solicited verses from Cooley to preface Thomas Spratt's History of the Royal Society, a book whose frontispiece he'd also designed. He also took it upon himself to defend the Society from its critics, whether they were ideological opponents such as Henry Stubb, or close friends such as Margaret Godolphin. These defenses are very different. To Cooley, he writes a panegyric on the Society's achievements. To John Beale, in the letter about Stubb, a piece of invective that draws on Thomas Nash's rhetoric in the Marlborough controversy in order to assimilate Stubb to earlier traditions of religious radicalism. And to Godolphin, a contrast between the Royal Society and the culture of the court, and an exercise in anti-theatrical polemic. Evelyn's fame as a gardener and arborist also put him in good stead in advancing its work. In 1681, he received a letter from the Barbados offering to provide the Society with plants and other materials and promising a complete natural history of the islands. He immediately sent it to Robert Hooke, though in the letterbook version it's readdressed to Christopher Wren, and volunteered to respond to the correspondent, William London, concerning the Society's deliberations. London's letter is still in the Royal Society Library. A note from Evelyn requesting its return is clearly ignored. He also includes a 1661 letter to John Wilkins concerning the anatomy of trees, which was read before the Society, and a letter to Francis Aston, the Society's secretary, which was also published in Philosophical Transactions, describing the disastrous effects of the severe winter of 1683-84. As well as letters discussing new agricultural technologies, such as the Semperdor, in a letter to the Earl of Sandwich, and the heated greenhouse, in a letter to Dudley Cullum. Later, he would also be involved in the exchange of plants with a group in Virginia, which included his cousin Daniel Park and some of the founders of the College of William and Mary. Such acts of mediation encompass both the extremities of geography and the stratified social worlds of the mechanical arts and the natural sciences. From this vantage point, the instructional essays to Pepys and other correspondents can be read as analogous acts of intellectual exchange. Here, Evelyn casts himself as an agent in the transmission of knowledge, which he envisaged as an organized process which moved from his library, through his commonplace books, in which the results of his study were organized, and ultimately through his letters to his correspondents. A letter of 1658 to his brother George offered to send him the frame or idea of my adversaria, which after many trials and reformations I find to be most advantageous. There are who do not oblige themselves to so much method and orderly reduction, but transcribe their observations fragmentarily and as they come to hand. For my own part, who experiment the benefit of it, reading a page or two every day till I have finished, and frequenting this lecture, I am satisfied with the design. This process had begun in 1649 with the assistance of his amanuensis, Richard Hoare, when he decided that he would have time to reduce my studies into a method after his return to France. Such procedures could be represented by various models. In a 1661 letter to Henry Bennett, Evelyn offers an alternative to a model based on commonplacing and its related metaphors of plants and bees, replacing it with a language of scientific experimentation and representing the transfer of knowledge as a distillation from its raw materials. Whilst there my seniors could not vacate the turning over those many larger volumes which adorned their libraries and were daily presented to them, they had yet their operators who extracted for them the elixir and by a more compendious art stored them with all those excellent notices. Even if the idea of such an organized process seems to occupy a mental space somewhere between a model and a fantasy of the circulation of knowledge, it speaks powerfully to Evelyn's representation of himself as a polymath, conversant in the old and the new learning. The range of topics Evelyn addresses can be construed as an intellectual self-portrait. The earliest essay, from 1657, is a critical response to a manuscript by Edward Thurland on the efficacy of prayer. Many later letters also address issues traversed by theological controversy. Two to Robert Heath in 1659 examine Hebrew vowel points and consider the implications of this problem for arguments about biblical inerrancy, particularly in the wake of Walton's Biblia Polyglotta. Another, drawing heavily on Jeremy Taylor, responds to the Irish priest Patrick McGinn in defense of the Church of England and its position on the Eucharist. In another case, a response to the Franciscan Christopher Davenport on the question of the invocation of saints, the letter seems to be a product of a collaborative effort in which Evelyn drew on material from Edward Stillingfleet and Thomas Barlow. But he is also at pains to demonstrate his classical learning. One letter of 1659 is an exercise in paradox, which draws on his research for Elysium Britannicum to show that the evidence of antiquity proves the gardener a better husband than the aristocrat. Another of 1685 is the letter to Pepys, which discourses on the use of colors in the navies of the ancient world. But Evelyn equally wishes to demonstrate his deep engagement with the new world of experimental science, whether through his letters to Robert Boyle or the biography of Boyle he provided to William Wotton in 1696, his passionate defense of the Royal Society in response to Margaret Godolphin's praise of the Shadwell's virtuoso, or his learned discourse to Thomas Tennyson on earthquakes and volcanoes. In 1656, William Rand dedicated his translation of Gassendi's biography of Pyrrhus to Evelyn, identifying him as a model for a more intellectually engaged English gentry. The completely knowing man, Rand suggests, must be Janus-like, double-faced, to take cognizance of time past and to understand the world from its cradle, as well as of the late past or present times wherein he lives. In his letter books, Evelyn endeavors to bear out this characterization. He felt himself to be living in the beginning of a new era. One of his later commonplace books begins with the observation that, till about 1648, it would have been accounted a presumptuous thing to have attempted any innovation in the common course of learning. They thought there could be nothing comparable to the physics and the courses of the philosophy and sciences taught in the universities, and that one should have been cried out upon as a vain projector to think that anything could be added to these hypotheses. He looks back to the intellectual world which encompassed classical antiquity and the humanist culture of the earlier Renaissance, but also looks forward to the remapping of knowledge and the new practices summoned into existence in the wake of Baconian science and the founding of the Royal Society. In his letter books, he is at pains to represent himself as conversant with both, but also as someone capable of arbitrating between them. These two ambitions converge at several points, but nowhere more forcefully than in his 1696 letter to William Wotton on the relative merits of the gardening and husbandry of the ancients and moderns, which praises the achievements of the moderns even as it looks back to the ancient world. Evelyn was perhaps one of the last figures capable of imagining himself as a genuine polymath, and as one who could move between these increasingly divergent worlds of learning, and within the complex social networks which traversed late 17th century England. His letters, I think, are intended to offer the proof of this. Thanks.